It is Thursday, December 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President-elect Donald Trump's nominee to head the Environmental Protection Agency is a critic of the carbon emissions plan. We look at how the future of Aleppo impacts Syria as a whole. And we hear about this year's Grammy Award nominees from the world of country music. It's all ahead. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump's choice to lead the Environmental Protection Agency is a strong critic of President Barack Obama's plan to address climate change by slashing carbon emissions from the nation's power plants. Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt was among the officials from 27 states who filed a lawsuit earlier this year seeking to block the Clean Power Plan, which through the EPA called for states to come up with ways to reduce overall emissions by 32% below 2005 levels by 2030. I spoke with Martha Joint Kumar, director of the White House Transition Project, a nonpartisan organization that helps members of incoming administrations adjust to their new duties. She's a historian and author of the book Before the Oath. I asked her about the controversy surrounding the Pruitt nomination.
I think that what he's interested in doing is achieving a balance where he makes sure to take in the concerns of the people who brought him there, his constituents, and then having other nominees who represent a broader constituency. And environmental regulations were an important aspect of what his constituents wanted in terms of less government.
Mr. Trump has named both government officials, but also people from private industry to his cabinet. You know, again, I guess this is sort of a mix of the type of people that he wants.
Right, and I think that's going to be traditional for a Republican president because the businesses are their base. That's where they draw from. And in his case, he's a businessman. He has no elective experience. Business is what he knows, and those are the people that he's going to bring in. Although you can see he's brought in three generals, so he's been looking at the military as well.
He's also brought in some quite wealthy people. There's a couple of surveys say that his cabinet pick so far, there's a combined wealth of $14.5 billion.
Again, that is his base. He's looking for successful business people, and part of that is the demonstrated success of their tenure in business. And so it's natural for him to bring in people who have achieved, and particularly in terms of the dollars that they've made in business. For Democrats, you have a different base. You bring in people from NGOs, people who have headed organizations that have represented particular constituencies within the Democratic coalition and can speak for them.
During the campaign, Mr. Trump was quite critical of President Barack Obama, but it seems like in the last few days he's had positive things to say about Mr. Obama, saying that they've had conversations, they had a meeting, of course, one-on-one at the White House, but they've been talking on the phone and they have a good relationship. It seems quite a switch from the campaign.
It is. And that's the switch from campaigning to governing, from being a candidate of a particular party to being a president of all the people. And I think as a businessman, he's used to talking to people and learning from them. And who better to talk to learn about the presidency than the incumbent president, Barack Obama. And Obama, for his part, is very interested in talking to Donald Trump so that he can provide him with information about the complexities of issues and the need to get your appointments in order to get up and running.
Yeah, because I know there's been some concern among the officials from Mr. Obama's group. So basically, they're kind of concerned about the pace of what is known as the agency level transition, which I guess is under the cabinet level.
It's both the departments and agencies. One of the aspects of the transition is the incoming administration is going to send in people to all the departments and agencies to gather information on budgets, on programs, personnel, positions, schedules for the upcoming year, because the government is a moving train and it's continually in operation, and a new administration has to jump on that train and they need information to do it. So that's why they send in people into the departments and agencies. And they've been slower than the Obama people were. They signed their memorandum of understanding, which between the transition and the incumbent administration, on Saturday after the election, and their teams went in starting the following Monday. So they had been working on their teams, developing who was they were going to send in.
Martha Joynt Kumar, director of the White House Transition Project. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, there's been a lot of talk about Scott Pruitt's nomination to the EPA because he is suing the agency and how he's a fierce opponent of the EPA. News breaking just as I've come in here, being reported by several news organizations, including the New York Times, is that Donald Trump's expected to name Andrew Pudzder Secretary of Labor. Now, he's the CEO of a restaurant group that includes Hardee's and Carl's Jr. restaurants. And as a lot of people are already noting on social media, he's a critic of labor regulation. So this seems to be a trend that people are picking up on, that Donald Trump seems to be appointing people who are critical, perhaps, of the agencies that they're running. Perhaps some of that drain the swamp rhetoric that he talked about coming into action. Also trending today on social media, John Lennon. Today marks the 36th anniversary of his untimely death, so we're seeing a lot of John Lennon lyrics, quotes, and remembrances still having a very strong impact on people 36 years after he passed away. And then finally, we've talked about on the show several times the fake news epidemic and how it played a role in the election. Well, someone's weighing in on fake news, and it's a pretty weighty figure. Pope Francis has come out in an interview and said that the fake news, quote, directs opinion in only one direction and omits the part of the truth. So speaking very strongly in that interview with the Spanish language news media, he also talked about the media's obsession with scandal and smearing people's reputations. So very strong words from a very high up person about the epidemic. We'll see if that leads to any changes or if it continues to grow. But the Pope is weighing in and he's not happy.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. A bipartisan effort is underway to investigate Russia's involvement in the U.S. presidential election. Ghanaians are awaiting the official results from their recent elections. Afghans are paying $3 billion in bribes annually, and a Greek court denies an extradition request for three Turkish soldiers accused in the coup attempt. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Health issues from asthma, lung cancer, and heart disease to reproductive and developmental disorders have long been linked to air pollution. A new study suggests that air pollution can also be connected to an increased prevalence of high blood pressure. The study followed over 41,000 people in five countries for 5 to 9 years and investigated the health effects of not only air pollution, but also traffic noise. The research indicates that one additional adult per 100 of the same age group who lived in the most polluted areas develops high blood pressure than those who live in less polluted areas. The study also shows that 6% of those who live on streets with an average nighttime noise level of 50 decibels or more had a higher risk of developing high blood pressure than those who live on streets with nighttime noise levels that were lower. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll look at the Grammy Award nominees from country music. Russia's deputy foreign minister said Thursday the U.S. and Russia are close to reaching an understanding on the fate of the Syrian city of Aleppo. He referred to an intensive document exchange, but cautioned against high expectations. Russia has demanded that rebel forces present in Syria's biggest city since 2012 leave. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has been meeting with his American counterpart, Secretary of State John Kerry, in Germany. Mark Toner is a U.S. State Department spokesman.
It is about trying to find a way to bring about a pause in the fighting. And we all know the elements involved in that. And certainly one of those is the opposition, finding a way for them to either get passage out of Aleppo or to find some way to at least bring about a pause in the fighting. So that humanitarian assistance and medical assistance can get in to Aleppo. There are various proposals being worked through. You know, there's ideas on the table that are being discussed on how to get there. Those are still being worked out, so I don't want to get ahead of that.
As government and allied forces continue to press their offensive against the dwindling rebel stronghold in eastern Aleppo, President Bashar al-Assad told state-run television Wednesday, victory will be a huge step in ending his country's nearly six-year war. He predicted it will change the course of the battle. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal tells International Edition's Victor Beatty he agrees.
Because what will happen is, as it has been stated several times and for good reason, once Aleppo falls, the civil war as we know it will basically be over. But then it will give rise to another different kind of war. It will be a war in which the opposition will not be fragmented in different groups, but will actually get united, because in that unison will lie their security. And then they will choose their areas or their places of conflict rather than allowing them to be besieged in a place like Aleppo by the Assad government with the support of the Iranians and the Russians.
Secretary of State John Kerry met with his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. What has this conflict done to U.S.-Russian relations?
Hard to tell, and I think we'll have to wait and see how things evolve. If the Russians decide that they have won, they have established their hegemonic role in the Middle East, and therefore they tend to don't go any further than that, then some degree of normal relationship between the United States and Russia will develop. But it will be a new mode in which both sides will understand how far they can push each other.
What happens once the fighting ceases in Aleppo?
There will be a bombardment of the eastern sector of Aleppo, and you can expect several hundred people will be killed, and some of them will be the rebels. But remember, the number of rebels have already left Aleppo. They have all moved out before the avenues for them closed down. What happened was that there was a deal worked out among the rebels themselves. Some of the rebels chose to stay back in order to provide cover to other rebels to move out. And a number of rebels have already moved out, and they're working out arrangements with the Al-Qaeda groups, as well as, in fact, with the ISIS as well. But the new front will be a moving front, where these rebels will choose where they want to attack, how they want to attack. It will be more like a usual guerrilla war rather than a pitched confrontation with the army, as was the case in Aleppo.
That's Zubair Iqbal of the Middle East Institute. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
The nominees for the prestigious Grammy Awards were announced this week. Nikki Strong of VOA 1 is here to weigh in on how country music fared. So, Nikki, were there any surprises?
Of course there were. It wouldn't be the Grammys if they didn't have surprises. So there were two immediate surprises that really jumped out at me. Sturgill Simpson's nominations for the all-genre category Best Album of the Year and Best Country Album of the Year for A Sailor's Guide to Earth. Now, what is so surprising is that he's been an outcast for the most part in country music because his music doesn't fit nicely into pre-established traditional or contemporary commercial country music categories, and he's been critical of the establishment, so he really hasn't gotten much airplay. He hasn't been acknowledged at all in any of the country music awards, so he's been almost off the radar. And so it's like the Grammys said, you know, you may marginalize your offspring, but, you know, for his innovative work, we're going to acknowledge and honor him and align him with superstars. He's going up against Adele, Beyonce, Justin Bieber, and Drake. That is major company.
Pretty stiff competition
there. Oh, my God. Yes, yes. And another surprise is that women did as well as they did. For the all-genre best new artist, there's usually a country artist, at least one in there. There are two this year, and they're both women, Maren Morris and Kelsey Ballerini. So I was excited about that. And then for best country solo performance, 4 out of 5 nominees are women. So you have Brandi Clark, Love Can Go to Hell, Miranda Lambert, Vice, Maren Morris, My Church, Carrie Underwood, Church Bells, and Keith Urban, Blue Ain't Your Color. Two other small surprises. I was surprised that for Best Country Album, Eric Church didn't get nominated since he did win the CMA Award for Best Album of the Year. And many critics were also disappointed that Margot Price was snubbed as well.
Any predictions?
Wow. Okay. Maren Morris was nominated for 4. She's been pitched and, you know, touted as the it girl. I think she'll win one. I think she will win at least, possibly for Best Country Solo Performance for My Church, or possibly Best Song. But the competition is really, really fierce. I saw her performance at the CMAs of My Church, and I thought it was wonderful. And I thought it really added depth to the song. And I think she might be able to walk away with that one. Keith Urban has 3. I think he may win for Best Country Album. Now, I'll be honest, he goes up against Brandi Clark, Big Day in a Small Town, Loretta Lynn, Full Circle, Maren Morris again for Hero, Sturgill Simpson, A Sailor's Guide to Earth, and Keith Urban, Ripcord. His album is great. I personally am just crossing my fingers that Brandi Clark will win this time because I think she's an incredible songwriter and a phenomenal talent who has yet to get her due. And I think part of it is because she's a woman and she's not a dolled up young thing. She's, you know, a grown woman. She comes as she is. She's comfortable in her skin and she has the goods and she delivers and she's well respected. And I think it would be nice for her to walk away with that trophy. But I think Keith Urban may actually win that.
Who are some of the other nominees?
Well, you have the Best Country Duo Group Performance. There's Dierks Bentley with L. King, Different for Girls, Brothers Osborne, 21 Summer, Kenny Chesney with Pink, Setting the World on Fire, Pentatonix with Dolly Parton, a really cool version of Jolene, Chris Young with Cassidy Pope, Think of You. Any of them could win. I have no idea. For Best Country Song, which is awarded to songwriters, you have Keith Urban, Blue Ain't Your Color. I love that song. Thomas Rhett, Die a Happy Man, another great song. Tim McGraw, Humble and Kind, one of my favorites that's already won awards this year. Maren Morris, My Church, which has like been an anthem for so many of us who live in the country. And Miranda Lambert's great song, Vice. I don't know who will win that one either, but we'll find out February 12th next year.
Well, you can hear music from these nominees and more on VOA One's Country Hits with Nikki Strong. You can also reach Nikki on Facebook and Twitter at VOA One The Hits. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Looks good on the sky. Looks good on that neon buzzing on the wall, but darling, it don't match your eyes.
And That is the music of Keith Urban singing the song Blue Ain't Your Color. Well, being optimistic could lengthen your life. That's according to a new study. Writing in the American Journal of Epidemiology, researchers at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health found that women with a general expectation that good things will happen had significantly lower risk of several deadly diseases such as cancer, heart disease, stroke, respiratory disease, and infection compared to less optimistic women. Eric Kim, research fellow in the Department of Social and Behavioral Sciences and co-lead author of the study, said, while most medical and public health efforts today focus on reducing risk factors for diseases, evidence has been mounting that enhancing psychological resilience may also make a difference. Furthermore, researchers found healthy behaviors only partially explain the link between optimism and reduced mortality risk. For the study, researchers looked at data from 70,000 female participants in the Nurses' Health Study, which examines women's health every 2 years via surveys. And that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a unanimous vote, the United Nations Security Council adopted a resolution November 30th imposing new and expanded sanctions on North Korea, also known as the DPRK, in response to that country's fifth and most recent nuclear test on September 9th. Resolution 2321 condemned the test and reaffirmed the DPRK's obligations not to conduct any further nuclear tests or launches that use ballistic missile technology, and to abandon all nuclear weapons and existing nuclear programs in a completely verifiable and irreversible manner. The sanctions take aim at North Korea's ability to raise the hard currency it needs to fund its nuclear and missile programs, imposing a binding cap on North Korea's coal exports, reducing them by approximately $700 million a year, that is, by more than 60%. It also bans the export of monuments, which generate millions of dollars through contracts around the world, and it prohibits North Korean exports of non-ferrous materials, copper, nickel, silver, and zinc, that provide approximately $100 million in hard currency to the regime annually. Speaking after the adoption of the resolution, U.S. Ambassador and Permanent Representative to the U.N. Samantha Power pointed out that among other measures, the resolution also targets North Korea's use of its diplomats to funnel in financial resources to fund its nefarious programs, and noted that the resolution threatens to suspend North Korea's rights and privileges at the United Nations if it continues to defy its obligations as a U.N. member state. In addition, Ambassador Power noted that for the first time, the Security Council included provisions that call on the DPRK to respect the inherent dignity of the North Korean people, an inclusion she called significant. Ambassador Power said that Resolution 2321 sends a clear message that the international community is united in continuing to work together to increase the pressure to defend itself from the pernicious threat to international order posed by the DPRK. U.S. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner emphasized that the expanded sanctions are not directed at the long-suffering people of North Korea, but at the ruling elite, who are responsible for violating multiple Security Council resolutions in their reckless pursuit of nuclear weapons.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.